national responses to European and global issues, the role of gender in international relations, was a symposium that was organized on December 15, 2010 at Aula Magna in Valletta. The symposium was organized by the Department of International Relations, and in this part of the symposium, we worked in collaboration with the Embassy of the United States to organize a video conference with Professor Joshua S. Goldstein.
The U.S. Embassy is always very happy to work with the Department of International Relations at the University of Malta. Today, it is our great pleasure to have been able to get Professor Goldstein to speak on how militaries construct and reinforce dominant ideologies of masculinity and femininity as part of today's event on the role of gender in international relations. Professor Goldstein is a graduate of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Stanford University and has taught at the American University in D.C., the University of Massachusetts, the University of Maryland, Yale, Brown University, the University of Southern Carolina, and the Harvard University Center for International Affairs. He has received many grants and awards and has published numerous books and articles on international relations. So without further ado, may I present Professor Goldstein.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and conference organizers and those who made the video conference possible. And thank you for sending your excellent questions, which I've received ahead of time. To do justice to the topic and to all your wonderful questions would take several hours, which we don't have, so I'm going to go very fast. And I'm mostly speaking about material that's in my book, War and Gender, which is on the screen here. So war is probably the most gendered of all human activities, except for childbirth and breastfeeding. The men are in the fighter roles, and the women are traditionally in civilian or protected roles, as we see in these the scene here with a French peacekeeper in Bosnia. The UN Security Council Resolution 1325, talking about women in war, uses the word protect 7 times in the resolution. So clearly this is a very important concept that people have about women in war, that they are traditionally the protected group. And historically, war has been gendered in this way since tribal societies and straight through to industrial societies, with men as the fighters in war. Nor is this just historical. Today's armies, uniformed regular armies, have about 20 million soldiers, and about 97% of them are men. The designated combat forces in the world are several million soldiers, and well over 99% of them are men. And even the peacekeeping forces, although it's beginning to change, are overwhelmingly male in their composition. This reflects the militaries of the contributing countries to peacekeeping forces. And strangely, as the status of women has risen over the centuries and in recent years, war has been one of the last holdouts in which women have not changed status as quickly as in other areas. In the United States, for instance, we no longer have any formal restrictions on women as lawyers, as doctors, as politicians, police, firefighters, and yet we still have a formal restriction on women in combat. So I have a 17-year-old son now, and when he turns 18 next year, he will send in this postcard to the United States conscription system, the selective service system, to register for the draft. We don't have a draft anymore, but we maintain this ritual of registering for the draft. And you'll notice the first word on this postcard, the big word, is men. And there's a subtext on it that is, men, be a man. You can. The previous version of this card said, you can handle it. Now it's, do the right thing. So there's a message here about masculinity that is being played upon to get men to register for the draft and to take up their role, even though we don't really have them in that role anymore because we don't use the draft. Draftees would only get in the way of fighting American wars. So why do societies organize this way, to fight wars in a gendered way? Presumably, there could be 3 reasons for this. 1, men are bigger, stronger, and faster than women, so they would make better fighters. 2, when women have tried to fight, they failed at it. Or 3, that men are natural-born killers, but women are naturally more peaceful. It turns out none of these explanations work, and I'd like to run through them each for the short time that we have. First of all, that men are bigger, stronger, and faster. These are all true in a sense, but they're true only in terms of group averages. In fact, there are overlapping curves of the women's capabilities and the men's capabilities, and they're shifted from each other. So the groups differ from each other, but individuals are spread out in their capabilities. And yet we think of these often as though they were categorical differences. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Men are all tall, women are all short, and so forth. And clearly, this gets us in trouble when we're looking at bell curves. Let me run through a few very quickly. So this is the categorical differences at the bottom, but the actual kinds of differences at the top. Now, here are some actual data on height. Men tend to be taller than women, but there's some overlap. There are some very tall women and some very short men. Lifting capacity, upper body strength. These are from U.S. soldiers back in the 1980s. I'm sure the curves overlap more now than they did at that time. This was when men were spending their whole lives trying to get strong and women trying to get thin. And so even so, you see that there's a group of women who are have some strong upper body strength and overlap into the men's curve to some extent. If we look at speed here, this is the New York Marathon. If you stood at the end of that race and watched people running across, there are 30,000 runners. The first 30 or 40 are all men. Then you get women, mostly men, and then it's just a mix of men and women for the most of the race. And so there's a lot of overlap there. In verbal ability, which could be useful in communicating on the battlefield, women are in the stronger position here. But again, there's a lot of overlap so that some men can communicate well. I hope I'm one of them today. And this measure of harm avoidance, in this case, what would be useful in war is not to be too much avoiding harm. You have to be brave and take initiative. But again, there's not that much difference between the men and the women's curves, although they do overlap. So now here's the argument. How much do we mobilize a population for war? Varies a lot from war to war. In some situations, just a small elite fights the wars for society. In other cases, almost the whole society is mobilized for a war. And this should affect the gender composition of the forces. Because when you have just a small elite, you can see you're sampling from the tail of that bell curve, and it would be like taking those top 30 men finishing the New York Marathon. They would be all men. Whereas if you're mobilizing a whole society, such as in the world wars, or some tribal societies that are fighting wars constantly, then you would expect to find a mix of some women in with the men, as you would if you were sampling a larger number of those runners in the marathon. But that's not what you find. What you actually find is that whether the mobilization is large or small, elite or the whole society, it's still almost all men, almost entirely men who fight the wars, historically. And even when there's an all-out war, such as the world wars, there's a tremendous resistance to using women in fighting roles. And even if a society is universally drafting men into the military, it's very rare to draft women at all. And when they are, they're usually drafted for a shorter time or with more restrictions. And actually, the case where women have most successfully integrated into the military is the United States today, and that is not a case of mass mobilization. That's more of a case of an elite fighting force. So the data just don't fit this idea in terms of the bell curves, that men's superior height, strength, upper body strength, and so forth would be the reason that men fight the wars. A second way to look at this is that as technology changes, you should find gender differences in physical strength becoming less important. So the individual's upper body strength and speed would be less important as technology develops. And this, too, should change the gender composition of forces. As technology takes over, women should integrate into militaries over history. The first big technology change along these lines was the introduction of horses in ancient warfare. They were tremendously important in fighting wars, and we know that women are just as good at riding horses as men, because in the Olympic Games, the equestrian, the horse riding events, are gender integrated. They are the only events in which women and men compete together. So women are just as good with horses as men are. Horses suddenly play a big role in war, and yet the women were not brought in to fight in those wars as horses were introduced. Next we have firearms introduced. These are some women who were training men how to fight, how to fire guns in the U.S. Navy in World War II. They could train the men, but they were not allowed to fight with those guns themselves. And yet we know that women can fire guns just as well as men can. Finally, we get to mechanized warfare and ultimately aviation. When you get to aviation, the men's larger size actually is not even an advantage. An aircraft designer would rather design for that smaller size pilot than the larger pilot, because more room in the cockpit for instruments and weaponry, and a smaller distance between the pilot's heart and brain to withstand the G-force. So as we progress into industrialized and warfare and aviation, you would think women would be actually the majority of fighters. Now, it's true that women play a larger role in aviation in all the NATO countries than they do in ground combat, but it's still a small minority of the forces. So there's a tremendous stickiness of the culture of gender in war. As technology changes, we really do not find that the use of women in armed forces changes along with it. Now, speeding ahead, the second idea here is that maybe for whatever reason, when women have tried to fight in wars, they just have not succeeded at it, and that's why armies don't use them in warfare. So, first of all, let's dismiss this idea of ancient Amazons, armies made up of women representing societies in which women had political power. There's no evidence that such a society ever existed, and there are many reasons to believe it never did exist. What is real is that individual fighters, women, have dressed up as men and gone off to war. This was very famous in the U.S. Civil War. A number of women did so. This woman here, Sarah Edmonds, actually was granted a pension by the U.S. Congress for the time that a woman got a veteran's benefit for her fighting in the U.S. Civil War. She was found out after the war as a woman. And these women are found out only after they're wounded or killed in the war, but many were never discovered because soldiers were buried in mass graves after a war with their gender never discovered. So we don't really know how many women have fought in the world's wars dressed up as men. Today we do physical exams with soldiers, but in historical times this was not the case. If you signed up to fight, you were given a weapon and sent out to fight. These individual fighters don't upset the overall gender pattern of war, because they're just treated as separate, as either their gender is not discovered, or in small cases, women, as women, openly in their gender, have fought in wars, but they don't upset the overall pattern. They're treated as anomalies. Or as a Russian officer said when the Naval Academy there first admitted a female cadet a few years ago, he said, "One girl alone cannot ruin the Navy." And this is the attitude towards individual women who have fought as women alongside the men. Women have also been military leaders effectively throughout history. These are the Vietnamese sisters who drove the Chinese out 2,000 years ago. And women have also participated frequently in guerrilla and militia forces, or the resistance forces in the world wars. Much more often than in regular uniformed state armies. So when warfare becomes irregular, out of uniform, militia forces, underground forces, terrorist guerrillas, then there's more capability for women to participate in war, and in these cases they've been very successful at what they did. In a few cases, women have participated in regular uniformed state armies. These are very rare cases, but they're instructive. One was in the 19th century Dahomey Kingdom in West Africa. Women were about a third of the regular army, They trained with the men, they fought with the men, they were the shock troops, and they turned the tide of several battles. So it's a proof that women can participate in regular armies very effectively. In the Soviet Union during World War II, desperate times, women were also used in the Red Army as fighters, some as nurses who were also frontline fighters, and in particular dragged many wounded soldiers back out of the battle. We sometimes hear the argument that women couldn't be in combat because they wouldn't be able to drag their wounded male comrades off the battlefield. Well, these Soviet nurses proved that that's true. And also famously, there were Soviet women pilots who fought in World War II. These ones had highly combustible, flammable, fragile biplanes, and they would go over the German lines at night because they would never survive by day, and drop bombs on the Germans all night long. They were called the Night Witches, and they were effective part of the Soviet war effort. In Eritrea, during the civil war to gain independence from Ethiopia, the women participated. And after the Eritrean army became a regular state army, women were still in the forces, so you then had two regular armies, Ethiopia and Eritrea, fighting trench warfare, ended about 10 years ago, and women were participants in that war, and again, fought very well. So let me say a couple of words about how women are used in the U.S. military recently. Although women now make up about 15% of the United States military, they are still concentrated in, if you look at the right graph, the top half, healthcare and administration, traditional feminine roles. It was the secretaries and the nurses, now it's the administrators and the doctors. Women still are concentrated in those roles, though they now make up a bigger percentage than ever of the total force. Women do participate in the U.S. forces in aviation in all roles, including combat aviation. And this is not always just dropping bombs from up in the sky. This woman, Kim Campbell, was flying the A-10 Warthog. It's a highly armored, slow-flying plane with a big machine gun in front that shoots up tanks. Up close and personal, low altitude, low speed. And she successfully brought her plane back after it was all shot up in the Iraq War, but didn't get much attention for it. Anyway, this woman won the first Silver Star combat that a woman has won in the U.S. forces for her role in Iraq. She is part of the military police, and the military police have become the back door to combat for U.S. women soldiers. So women officially are not allowed in combat units, but they are allowed in military police, and as such, they're out riding around with machine guns, participating in combat every day, shooting up the enemy. This one was escorting a convoy that came under fire and ended up in a big firefight and saved her comrades there. Now, women have also played specific female-related roles in the U.S. military in recent years because, especially in the cultures that we're fighting in now, such as Iraq and Afghanistan, we've gotten into big trouble when men come into civilian areas, say, kicking down doors of houses to search at night, and they discovered that they really do better with some women along. Well, this was a problem because women are banned from these units that are the combat units kicking down doors. So what the U.S. military did is to borrow women from non-combat units, attach them to these combat units, put them in the front of these combat raids so that they would signal that we're not here to rape your women, and then the women could search women, Iraqi women and now Afghan women, in a way that men couldn't do. So here we have the women officially barred from combat. They were called the lionesses in Iraq, and yet participating with the combat units. We did run into trouble in Iraq by having this official ban on combat because in the town of Fallujah, where Marines were fighting, there was a fortified Marine base in town, and women were not allowed to stay at that base because then they would be part of this combat unit. So instead, because they were needed there, the military, the Marines, trucked them in unarmored trucks every day to the town and back again. So, of course, the insurgents figured this out, and they blew up a truck, and we lost four women Marines that way. They actually would have been safer as part of the designated combat unit. But we have these odd arrangements to make it appear that women are not fighting when, in fact, they are. In Afghanistan, most recently, we have what are called female engagement teams. And these are all women groups of about 40 soldiers, in this case Marines. And they go out to win the hearts and minds of the population, to talk with women in villages, places that the men Marines can't go to. The women can go, and they gather intelligence, and they make friends with the local population there. This was our first female engagement team last year, and now we have a new team. So they've trained for this mission, they train with a group of all women, and then they've deployed to Iraq. In peacekeeping, also women can play unique roles, and have recently. These are Swedish peacekeepers in Croatia. The men are trying to talk with the woman behind the window, but she won't come out and talk with them. So they bring in a woman translator, and they still won't come out and talk. So they bring in all women. I'm sorry, they bring in some women soldiers. Then they bring in all women soldiers, but the man is still the translator. And then finally, they bring in all women soldiers and a woman translator, and then this person behind the window comes out and talks. So these are important things for a military force to be able to deal with the local population. It's a matter of force protection, intelligence gathering, operational effectiveness for the military. There are some problems with integration of women in forces, but I'm not going to go into them now because of shortness of time. Okay, the last idea, that men are natural-born killers. Maybe this is why, because women are naturally peaceful, although I don't know why they were so successful at fighting then. But people often say that men are natural killers, women are naturally peaceful, and that's why genders are militaries are gendered the way that they are. Testosterone, the male sex hormone, is responsible for all the major biological differences between the genders, but is widely misunderstood. So people think the amount of testosterone causes an amount of aggression. Men have more testosterone, so they were more aggressive, so then they would make better soldiers. In actual fact, it's a lot more complicated than that. And I won't go into the detail, but testosterone, rather than causing aggression, actually responds to changes in status, social status. So if men fight, the winner of the fight has an increase in testosterone level, and the loser of the fight has a decrease. And yet, violence and sex are not naturally connected because testosterone runs counter to the stress hormones. So the sex hormones and the stress hormones are going in opposite directions. And this makes the front lines of a war where combat and violence are going on a particularly sexless place. Now, after combat, behind the lines and so forth, then there's issues of men away from home, groups of men and their interactions with local women and issues about sex. But the idea that somehow sex and violence are tied together and that men's testosterone drives aggression and violence doesn't hold up. I don't have time to tell you all the biology behind it, but that's the bottom line. Now, if men were natural killers, it would be easy to get them to fight. They would all sign up to participate in wars and go off eagerly. But this is not the case. In fact, war is extremely traumatic for men and for women who fight now. And it's very hard for societies to get men or women now to fight. It does not come naturally. We need to draft men into the military rather than just have them volunteer. We need to induct them and make them over, strip away their individuality. Here's our television personality, Stephen Colbert, went over to Iraq for a visit with the troops, and they gave him a military-style haircut. So these haircuts are symbolic of stripping away the individuality of the soldier and replacing it with a new identity as a soldier, breaking the ties with family and community, and unlearning the moral norms that we've learned for normal life, things like don't kill people. These have to be undone. Excuse me, in order to turn a man into a soldier. Then, in combat, many armies have used drugs or alcohol, other drugs. The British had the rum ration to get people to overcome their natural fears. And in West Africa, the boy soldiers recently were using a combination of amphetamines and gunpowder and other drugs to get them into a delusional state where they could participate in these traumatic events of killing and being killed. And then finally, if people run away during combat, which is the rational thing and the natural thing to do, then we shoot them as deserters. So extremely harsh punishments for those who refuse to participate. Combat is a horrific experience, marked by confusion, noise, terror, and atrocities, in addition to any actual physical injuries that soldiers sustain. And both men and women afterwards have suffered high rates of post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And then finally, after a war is over, many cultures have special honors for veterans to reward them for this difficult experience they've gone through in tribal societies, maybe winning wives and special positions in society. In a modern American society, we have the veterans' benefits, college education, and so forth. And also, medals are very important, recognition for soldiers like that Silver Star for combat that we saw. And by contrast, men who refuse to participate in war are often shamed as cowards, that they're too afraid and they are shunned by society and suffer from being ostracized from the group. So all of these inducements are ways to get men to participate in combat, and they show that getting that to happen is a very difficult job for societies, that just having men as natural killers would not do the job. Instead, we have to create versions of masculinity that appeal to men's concepts of their manhood in order to get them to fight. Many inducements, many ways to get soldiers to participate do not involve gender. Some are, drawing on patriotism, love of country. The biggest one is the love for one's buddies, the unit bonding, group bonding, which is male bonding if there are a group of soldiers fighting together, but it's not male bonding if there are men and women together fighting. The bonding works the same, but in that case it's just a group bonding and you couldn't call it male bonding. This is a big factor in soldiers' decision to fight. But in addition to those kind of not-gendered inducements, there also is a common theme of war service as a test of manhood, primarily of courage, that real men will pass this test and show themselves brave and participate in war. And men are also told that they are fighting to protect women at home and that this is an important part of their manliness. Societies use gender to mobilize for the population for war, as in this World War II American poster showing that the Japanese enemy is going to take our women and do bad things to them if men don't mobilize into the war and accept the traumas that come with that to fight to protect our women. Now, the actual idea of what's masculine changes from society to society and from time to time, but it often fits with what the society needs to fight wars. So these are two versions of our G.I. Joe doll, one from the Vietnam War era. We needed regular guys to pick up a rifle and go out into Vietnam, cannon fodder. And so the guy's kind of not particularly athletic, but he's got the gun and he's the G.I. Joe of the 1960s. Then we go forward to the 1990s, and we have G.I. Joe Extreme, he's all muscular, and this reflected the change of U.S. military forces to a more elite force with, special forces, anti-terrorists, and the kinds of qualities that we value today. Similarly, in France, Louis XIV, the Great War fighter, here is shown in a particularly masculine pose. Now, today, Americans would not find this a particularly masculine pose, but at the time, he saw that it was. So the idea is that the form of masculinity changes from time to time and society to society, but it usually is something that would help men to to participate in war. We started at an early age training boys for their potential role as soldiers, and every society faces the problem that it might have to go to war. It might be drawn into war. And so it will need soldiers, and you can't wait until boys are grown up to prepare for this. It starts at an early age. There is a biological element that the cultures build on, and that is the tendency of males, male primates, to engage in what we call rough and tumble play more often than female primates do. So boys are more likely than girls to say hello to each other at a young age by jumping on the other one, knocking them to the ground, and both laughing uproariously. And girls are less likely to appreciate that kind of greeting. We start at birth and in preschool, and from ages 1 to about 7, we tell boys, don't cry. Boys, don't cry. And yet it's perfectly as natural for boys to cry as for girls. And in fact, from age 1 to 7, there are no real biological differences between boys and girls. You can't even tell the difference between them if we don't dress them in the appropriate colors and styles. When they get into middle childhood, that is the age 10 or so, these boys here, then the genders tend to segregate, and the boys with their rough and tumble play tend to play in bigger spaces, participate in larger groups, and focus on sports more. And this may contain the seeds then of preparing them to traditionally participate in all male military groups. When boys hit adolescence, many cultures have rites of passage into manhood that vary cross-culturally, but have the common element of preparing for war. So the rituals often involve inflicting pain on adolescent males and forcing them not to cry out. And they're shamed for life if they cry out under pain. So they're being prepared for the kind of thing they'll need to do in a war. In some very war-prone societies, men have had to kill an enemy before they would be considered a man or to marry. And in others, there's almost universal conscription of men into the military, and this also serves as a ritual of passage into a kind of militarized manhood. So in summary, societies put great effort into making men into soldiers. This is not something that comes naturally. And incidentally, women are not all that peaceful either. In most wars, most women have supported the war, and they participate in various feminized roles in the war system, as lovers, as wives, as sweethearts. They promise their affections to the successful warriors and encourage them to fight. And they help, women have often helped to shame the men who don't fight. There was the famous White Feather campaign in World War I in England, where women would give a feather to a man of military age who was caught not off at war to shame them. Mothers also raised their boys to be soldiers. It's often said that if mothers decided to not have war, they could raise their boys not to fight, and that would be the end of it, but that never happens. Female citizens usually support their country's wars, although somewhat at a lower rate than men in recent years. And then women participate directly as nurses, munition workers, and support troops, and have actively supported wars in all societies. And then most recently, in especially the U.S. and NATO forces, women are beginning to participate directly as military police and other roles in armies. So, to summarize, why is war gendered in this way? It's not because women can't fight. And it's not because biological differences compel men and women into these different roles. But it's because societies need to prepare for the possibility of fighting wars, and they use gender roles and expectations and build on rather small biological differences to prepare men and women for gender-based incentives to participate in their roles if the society comes to be at war. I have more information on these topics at the website, warandgender.com. And you're welcome to go there also and find out more. So let me stop, and I think we have time for some questions. Do I see that the gendered roles in war are connected to gender in politics and women's position in political leadership in societies? And clearly these have been very much connected historically. The leadership of societies originally consisted of military leadership, the people who could wield power through the gun, and these were men, so they were also the political leadership of society. As we've developed democracy, this has changed somewhat, and women can vote now, women can run for office, and increasingly women are gaining some foothold in politics, certainly nothing like equality. To the extent that women are barred from participating in armed defense of their country, many women feel they're at a disadvantage politically. And this is directly true in the sense that many political leaders, less so now, but certainly up until recently, used military service as a path to gain political leadership. Most famously, generals like Dwight Eisenhower, who came from military leadership and into political leadership. This is obviously impossible if you're a woman and you're not allowed to be a general. There was also a question about whether women are now represented at the high ranks of officers in the American military, and the answer is yes, but in small numbers. Women do not have the path to even military leadership, which often comes through combat arms. There is one very high-ranking woman general now in the U.S. military who came up through the logistical side of the military forces. So that's a route women can follow. But mostly you have to have served in combat units in order to gain military leadership, and this also would help in political leadership as well. In some fundamental way, if men are armed and women are disarmed in a society, then this clearly will affect the political power that they wield in the society.
You have just said that if men are armed and women are not armed, then obviously at times women end up as being the victims. And one clear example of this is when women, when rape is used as a weapon of war. What can you tell us about this? Because it is, you know, still quite frequently used tactic, which we read about from time to time, unfortunately.
Thank you. It's very hard to get reliable information about rape in wartime. Actually, it's hard to get good data about rape in peacetime either. But if you even ask, is it more common to see rape during wartime than peacetime or in the armed forces versus civilian life, we really do not have good data to answer those questions. I will say that in many wars, not all wars, by a long stretch, but many wars, rape has been used as a method to assert control over a hostile population. And there are really two versions of this, one in which soldiers are, in a sense, rewarded by being allowed to rape women after conquering a population. And usually this is just bad discipline, or perhaps the leadership of a military turning the other way and not caring what soldiers do. Rape almost always in these cases goes with other atrocities, looting, massacres, tortures, killing men, women, and children, and rape is part of that continuum of atrocities in wartime. The second version of this problem occurs when leadership deliberately and systematically uses rape as a tactic to assert control over a population. And it's directed not just at the women victims, but also at the men of the society to humiliate them, to show that they're incapable of protecting their women, which is, as I said, a test of their manhood. So to humiliate and dominate the other side by using sexual violence, among other methods, this happens repeatedly, and sometimes on a very large scale, larger scale than we have today, historically. So in World War II, there were some very large-scale incidents, and in the India-Pakistan in 1948, and some other historical cases. Horrible incidents, far worse than what we see today, and we still see terrible incidents today, such as in the Eastern Democratic Congo with militias there. There's also the problem of rape within the armed forces, which we have been dealing with in the United States because of the integration of 15% of our forces being women. So these are difficult issues for the military leadership, because you have a large, when you have an expeditionary force such as we have in Iraq or Afghanistan, a large number of men are uprooted from their homes, taken away from their wives, girlfriends, mothers, and sent into another society. And their relations with the women in that society and with the women who are serving with them in the armed forces are very important to the success of the mission, and yet hard for military leaders to get right, because traditionally military officers have used sexual domination as a kind of theme to get men to fight, in the sense that the enemy is feminized to reinforce the soldier's own masculinity, and in the sense that the enemy women are considered to be classed to be humiliated and dominated. And the sexual domination is a script, a theme that it comes into play there. So if you do this and get it wrong as military officers, you will alienate a population and cause terrible problems and undermine your own mission. And yet traditionally these methods have been used in some wars for exactly that purpose, to dominate and humiliate as part of a war strategy. The interesting question from a research point of view is why some wars have these big problems with rape and sexual violence and atrocities of all kind, but other wars do not. So there are some researchers now studying this issue and looking at the different cases to figure out what it is that makes some wars go this way and other wars not go that way. It's far from universal. It's not at all true that every army rapes and commits atrocities. And it's also far from a rarity. It's common enough that it's a recurring pattern. So that we have to understand better what it is that allows these things to happen and how to get better control of them.
I have a question too. They recently allowed gay men to fully be able to join in the army, and what is the impact on the ending of the don't ask, don't tell policy, you think?
Yeah, good question. The gay men have been tied up with this idea that heterosexual masculinity is a theme to get men to fight. They're proving their manhood and so forth. And so if you let women into the forces, this calls into question how can they prove their manhood if a woman is doing the same thing that I'm doing. And similarly, having gay soldiers, according to some officers who worry about this, would call into question this idea of heterosexual masculinity, and especially if you're trying to use the idea of domination and sexual humiliation as a way to build up the soldier relative to the enemy. So they think it would be confusing to have gay men serving, and it would cause problems. Well, actually, don't ask, don't tell policy, which does not allow gay men and lesbians to serve in the U.S. military, has been used more against lesbians than against gay men. So that's one point. And the women soldiers seem to have much less trouble with lesbians serving side by side with them than the men soldiers do. The men soldiers and officers have a generation gap. The older ones are all troubled by the idea of gay men taking showers and being in close quarters and being in the foxhole with the heterosexual man. The younger soldiers, and especially those who have fought, have far less trouble with this. A survey recently you may have seen where the U.S. military asked soldiers how they felt about it, and the majority had no trouble with gay men serving with them, but the older ones had more trouble, and the more combat-oriented units, especially also had more trouble. So those that are relying more on a traditional idea of manhood to motivate soldiers had more trouble with this. We have and I don't know what's going to happen in terms of repealing the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. It looks as though maybe the military is ready for it, but the political leadership, the Congress, is not. I think someday soon it will be repealed, because other countries have done this and have found that it really did not affect their fighting abilities.
Hi. We normally tend to focus on large-scale wars, such as the War on Terror and other cross-border conflicts. But what sort of role do women and girl children play in guerrilla warfare and other smaller-scale conflicts?
So women's roles in terrorism and civil wars?
No, women's roles. We normally tend to focus on larger-scale wars, such as that of the War on Terror, for example. But what sort of role do women play in smaller-scale conflicts and guerrilla warfare?
Women play a much bigger role in small-scale conflict and guerrilla war. It's not so much the scale of the war as the type of war. So in regular uniformed armies, women play a smaller role, and in irregular guerrilla forces, such as terrorist groups and militias and guerrillas, women play a much larger role. But those could be very large-scale wars. For instance, women played a big role in the communist side in the Vietnam War. Although it was a large war, they were irregular forces and guerrillas. And similarly in Sri Lanka, which was a fairly large war, women played a major role in the Tamil Tigers. They were about a third of the total fighting force and not restricted from participating in combat. In fact, the Tamil Tigers pioneered the idea of suicide bombings and used women very effectively as suicide bombers. So this has unfortunately been copied now by other irregular and terrorist forces. Women in Russia recently were suicide bombers, and women in Iraq and Afghanistan have been suicide bombers. So because they are traditionally seen as non-combatants, and because guerrillas blur those lines between the uniformed forces and the non-combatants, then women can sneak in better to their targets and be under less suspicion and have played those kind of roles. But in all the guerrilla wars, women are allowed much more freedom to participate as fighters, and in the regular armies, much less so. You saw this in Israel in 1948 when the Zionist armed forces did include women fighting, and the moment that the country became independent and had a regular uniformed army, women were kicked out of combat roles there. But this is not unique to Israel, it's everywhere. I think that in the United States and other modern industrialized countries, militaries are moving away from the idea of masculinity as the underpinning of soldiers' motivation to fight. We're moving away from a gendered motivation and towards a professionalization of the military. So instead of, I'm fighting to prove my manhood, you hear, I'm fighting to do my job, what I was trained to do, and carry it out to accomplish the mission. And for my buddies, it's always for my buddies. But moving away from this masculinity idea and into more professionalized forces. And this works well with the integration of women, and also will work fine with gay soldiers serving side by side. It turns out that if a soldier is in a foxhole with another soldier, what he cares about is not whether the other soldier is gay. I mentioned earlier that sex is really not a factor in when you're out on the front lines fighting. What you care about if you're in a foxhole is whether the other soldier next to you is a good soldier and can carry out orders, and can shoot straight. And you would much rather have a gay soldier next to you who's a good shooter than a heterosexual guy who can't shoot straight. So I think that these political issues in Washington, D.C. will be overcome eventually, and that the military will get beyond this obsession with gay soldiers are going to undermine the forces somehow. We've seen a lot of change on this in the last 10 years, and probably we will see more. I would caution, though, that usually changes in gender roles, and in particular gay soldiers' ability to participate equally, happen most often during wartime. We need soldiers to fight, and we need good soldiers. Then after wars end and we have peacetime, then the military forces clean up their gender lines and kick the gay soldiers out and kick the women out and so forth. So this may happen if we ever get back to peacetime, which I hope we will someday. Thank you very much for inviting me, and I hope to come to Malta in person in the future and have a closer look.
National responses to European and global issues, the role of gender in international relations, was a symposium that was organized on December 15, 2010 at Aula Magna in Valletta. The symposium was organized by the Department of International Relations, and in this part of the symposium, we worked in collaboration with the Embassy of the United States to organize a video conference with Professor Joshua S. Goldstein.